Now the boy Samuel was ministering to the Lord under Eli. The word of the Lord was rare in those days. Visions were not widespread. At that time, Eli, whose eyesight had begun to grow dim, so that he could not see, was lying down in his room. The lamp of God had not yet gone out, and Samuel was lying down in the temple of the Lord, where the ark of God was. Then the Lord called, "Samuel, Samuel," and he said, "Here I am," and ran to Eli and said, "Here I am, for you call me." But he said, "I did not call, lie down again." So he went and lay down. And then the Lord called again, "Samuel, Samuel." Samuel got up and went to Eli and said, "Here I am, for you called me." But he said, "I did not call you, my son, lie down again." Now Samuel did not yet know the Lord, and the word of the Lord had not yet been revealed to him. The Lord called Samuel again, a third time, and he got up and went to Eli and said, "Here I am, for you called me." Then Eli perceived that the Lord was calling the boy. Therefore Eli said to Samuel, "Go, lie down, and if he calls you, you shall say, 'Speak, Lord, for your servant is listening.'" So Samuel went and lay down in his place. Now the Lord came and stood there, calling as before, "Samuel, Samuel." And Samuel said, "Speak, for your servant is listening." The next day, Jesus decided to go to Galilee. He found Philip and said to him, "Follow me." Now Philip was from Bethsaida, the city of Andrew and Peter. Philip found Nathanael and said to him, "We have found him about whom Moses is in the law, and also the prophets wrote, Jesus, son of Joseph, from Nazareth." Nathanael said to him, "Can anything good come out of Nazareth?" Philip said to him, "Come and see." When Jesus saw Nathanael coming towards him, he said of him, "Here is truly an Israelite in whom there is no deceit." Nathanael asked him, "Where did you come to know me?" Jesus answered, "I saw you under the fig tree before Philip called you." Nathanael replied, "Rabbi, you are the Son of God. You are the King of Israel." Jesus answered, "Do you believe because I told you that I saw you under the fig tree? You will see greater things than these." And he said to him, "Very truly I tell you, you will see heaven opened and the angels of God ascending and descending upon the Son of Man." This is the word of the Lord.
It's an interesting week to be exploring these two stories, which could both be seen as stories about being called by God. Yesterday at Caroline's ordination, we heard her story of how God had worked through all kinds of experiences of life and choices that she's made to bring her through to the significant moment of making ordination vows. It's always a bit of a reminder for those who've done it before. Think about it. She talked about the ways she had heard God call to her and how she's responded. But the key to it all was God's call, something God was doing. And then, of course, as Bruce has said, there was this important church meeting, and you've issued a call to me that's based on an understanding of what God is doing and where God is calling this particular church. The process is one where we believe that God speaks through his people, and together then we discern God speaking to us, God's calling. So I've been trying to listen to God quite carefully this week. And a legitimate question for all of us to ask is, how do we know when it's God? It's also closely followed by, and who is this God who calls to people. These are particularly important questions for us to be asking in the light of all the different ways people are claiming to have heard God in order to justify actions taken and which become the basis on which to build life. The Bible is full of stories which tell of the way God speaks. You could argue that one of the main points of it is to demonstrate the lengths God takes to communicate and relate to people, just ordinary people. Seems to be one of the reasons for our existence. To borrow the words of Saint Augustine, which I don't do often, I have to say, "You have made us for yourself, O God, and our hearts are restless until they find their rest in you." Our hearts are restless until they find their rest in you. So one thing that seems clear from the Bible story is that the God we're invited to put our trust in does communicate with us in a variety of ways, whether that be by a direct shout out or through a messenger, as in the Christmas story and all the angels, or by dreams and visions, or even through nature. I would add that sometimes God speaks through absence too, which is not the same thing as not being there, but for many is one of the experiences of faith which has been most puzzling and difficult, and yet where they have learned the most. It's not that God speaks in such ways that we take no responsibility for ourselves and what we do or say. That would need a whole different sermon to unpack. So let's begin with what we have looked at and heard together. The beginning of John's Gospel tells us that Jesus was the Word that came to live with us, and yet the same Word that was there at the beginning of the world, at the creation. Quite a different introduction to Jesus from the other three Gospel writers. He tells us that in quite flowery language, and then the rest of the chapter gives witness to who Jesus was in a series of stories about John the Baptist and the first disciples, those that would hear the words of Jesus, "Follow me." The gospel is written by someone who knew the end of the story, who knew that this word and sign, with that there was also a cross and a resurrection, and the coming of the Holy Spirit. The whole book is written by John in the light of the destiny of Jesus to suffer rejection and condemnation by the world, and of the church's similar experiences of opposition from the authorities in John's own time and day. Witness is an important theme right through John's gospel. It's like a case in a law court, where all the relevant facts are presented for deliberation. So John calls forth witnesses to testify to who Jesus was, right through to his final trial. In this story about Philip and Nathanael, we begin to see the witnesses for the defense, you might say. Those that were going to tell others who it was they had met. Notice, though, that it's Jesus who finds and calls Philip, then Philip who goes to find Nathanael, and Nathanael then is surprised by Jesus when Jesus comes to Nathanael. It's Jesus instigating these meetings. He finds it difficult to believe Philip's claim to have found the Messiah, and he says so. A Messiah coming from Nazareth? Well, that's akin to a king being born in a stable. Nazareth is nothing. No mention in the Old Testament, the Talmud or Midrash, and roots are important. Philip's answer, well, just come and see. Come and see for yourself. And Nathanael has a most surprising meeting with Jesus. He gets a big surprise when Jesus seems to know him already. How could this be? Jesus surprises him even more by his answer, by his wise words. Nathanael discovers the Son of God and King of Israel, and him promised even greater things than that. Nathanael was expecting a Messiah. He was an Israelite who knew about these things. But his expectations were confined more to the idea of a Messiah than the reality of one turning up in quite an unexpected place. So Philip's invitation to come and see is an invitation to go beyond his blinkered, limited vision, to step out in faith, you might say. And he discovers a ladder between heaven and earth. Jesus links heaven and earth with his life. There's a glimpse here back to the Old Testament and Jacob's ladder between heaven and earth, but the ladder is no longer fixed in one place. It's dependent on one person, Jesus Christ, whom John will tell us later is the way to the Father. No one comes to the Father except through Jesus. He's at the center of the cosmos, the center of life itself, where heaven and earth touch. Well, we've heard it all before, but then it was a new idea. It was a surprise. It was beyond Nathanael's thinking. This really is a restoring of the relationship that was broken in the garden when those first people hid from God rather than enjoying his company. In the end, one of the questions of faith is, do we believe that God speaks through Jesus? Can we trust Jesus? And then there's Samuel. Samuel's late night call was as surprising to him as it was to Eli. They're very much in this together, young and old, working together, the one learning from the other. The previous chapter outlines how Eli's sons had gone away from God, and so the line of Eli was fading from the priesthood. Samuel was placed in the temple by his mother, in thankfulness for God's hearing her cry and ending her barrenness and shame. God had listened to her and answered her. These days, the thought of waiting all that time for a child and then giving him to a religious order to be brought up seems rather odd. I guess it was kind of the equivalent of a boarding school for learning to be a priest. Not quite Hogwarts, which I guess would be a modern way of looking at the idea. Just as Mary sang her song of protest, her Magnificat, so Hannah, Samuel's mother, lifted her heart and lungs and sang a song of love and praise that spoke of the God who lifted up the poor and needy, that was greater than the most powerful rulers, and in whose hands all the earth is held. It's a song which believes that God is sovereign. Quite a remarkable woman of faith. She speaks of things beyond her sphere of concern. Her experience leads her to believe that God is the Lord of heaven and earth and the source of all life. She believes what Nathanael was looking for. Whereas Eli displays a different kind of faith. If Hannah's was refreshing, Eli's was tired. Long years had passed working day in, day out in the temple, performing the rituals, listening to people's prayers and needs, holding before people God's ways and words, listening and more listening. When it talks about the need to keep the lamps burning, well, it's that sense that Eli had grown tired of waiting for God to speak. He'd even stopped waiting at the place where God would speak, and instead it's Samuel who waits there by the Ark of God. Eli's eyes had grown dim in more ways than one. The lamp may not have quite gone out, but the flame was flickering perilously close to it. We're told it was rare for the Lord to speak or give visions, and Eli had grown tired of being alert, and Samuel waited instead. Except Samuel didn't really know what he waited for. And for a while, neither did Eli. What a surprise it was then. And yet, a bittersweet moment for Eli when he realized what was happening and told Samuel what to say to God. He should have been ready and waiting. He should have been the one to whom God spoke. He'd lost the will to expect God, and instead, Samuel was there, and in his ignorance, waiting for the voice of God. And so it's Samuel who responds to the one he has yet to become acquainted with. God takes the initiative. God already knows Samuel. I can't help feeling sad for Eli. His story is a bit depressing, really. To have become so weary and disillusioned, disappointed with how his sons had turned out and living with a sense of failure. There's something very Eeyore-ish about Eli. When you come on a Sunday, is it with the expectation that God is going to meet you? Have you grown disappointed with God? Or disillusioned with being in church waiting for God to speak? So it's actually quite hard to go. Do you expect anything to change? Are you ever surprised by what God does? Or does it all seem so familiar, it's lost the power to move you? These are the questions Eli invites us to answer. Yet, Eli still had faith. It may have been at a low ebb, but it was still there. And there was generosity too. He didn't go stumping along the corridor and confront God. Why haven't you spoken to me? I've been waiting here for years for you to turn up. He recognized Samuel's calling and God's timing. Perhaps he was just glad that God was there still after all. There's a generosity about Eli. And in his own way, Eli should be remembered as someone who overcame his disappointment and made it possible for God to be heard again. Samuel's whole start was steeped in religion, but it was not enough. Samuel still needed help to encounter God himself, to find his own way with God. He couldn't do that on his mother's faith. He couldn't do it on Eli's faith as his teacher. He had to learn to recognize God himself, as must we all. What did Nathanael and Samuel have in common? They both found that they were already known, and they both found that God was seeking them, calling them. God was active and searching, just as God still seeks us today. God seeks us and then invites us to learn about him so that others might find him too through us. So it's a pass it on kind of faith that we're invited to share in for the good of all, for the building of the kingdom of God where peace and justice and love find their fullest expression. The God who calls to each one of us today.